You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you like running? Are you a fan of beer? How about snowshoes? We'll hear about a one-of-a-kind race in Eau Claire that brings all three of those things together.
First, the impasse over funding for a border wall took a primetime turn last night with President Trump's first primetime address to the nation. The president pushed for Democrats to grant his funding request, calling the situation at the U.S.-Mexico border both a humanitarian and national security crisis.
It came as the partial government shutdown rounded out its 18th day, and Democratic leadership got a chance to have their say with a response that followed right after.
Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Milwaukee. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Kathy, what was your reaction to the address from President Trump?
Well, one of the things that we know from a lot of political science research is that when presidents sort of take to the Oval Office and try to address the public nationally, as President Trump did last night, there isn't a lot of evidence that those sorts of addresses really move public opinion very much. So I think some people went into watching the president last night with the sense that it probably wasn't going to really kind of break the logjam in the negotiations over the shutdown. And if you watch reaction to it today, and if you look at some of the early public opinion, that seems to be what has happened. President Trump probably fortified support among supporters. He probably didn't convince many people who are opposed to the wall. And it seems that more than anything else, it's just sort of exacerbated tensions between him and some of the Democratic leaders in Congress, because meetings that they tried to have today didn't seem to turn out terribly well.
Kathy, does it make a difference where you give an address like this from? We talked about the fact that he gave this last night in the Oval Office. Does it make a difference if it's in, say, the Situation Room or the White House lawn, somewhere like that? Is there significance as to where you give an address like this at?
Well, you know, presidents usually like to use the Oval Office to really signal the gravity of a particular situation. And since President Trump wanted to frame his comments last night around this notion of a security crisis at the border with Mexico, I think, you know, that kind of gives us a sense of why he made that choice. There have been several commentators today who've talked about the fact that President Trump's speaking style is one in which he seems to be much better off when he has an audience and can feed off the energy of people around him, such that being alone in the Oval Office may actually not have played to his strengths and may not have made him come across in probably the way that he hoped. So presidents do use the Oval Office for, you know, particular strategic purposes. An address made in the Rose Garden, you know, probably has a different feel and a different flavor. But I'm not sure that President Trump was as successful last night, given that the setting might not have really played to his strengths.
Speaking of President Trump and the Oval Office address, we have a clip from last night's speech. Let's take a quick listen.
Over the years, thousands of Americans have been brutally killed by those who illegally entered our country, and thousands more lives will be lost if we don't act right now. This is a humanitarian crisis, a crisis of the heart, and a crisis of the soul.
Why do you think the president's position is shifting to a softer, more humanitarian focus?
Well, he's certainly not getting anywhere in negotiating with the leadership in Congress based on the idea that there is some security crisis, because I think all of the objective evidence and all of the sort of commentary from people at the border and government officials navigating the situation, they're all pushing back on his notion that there is some imminent security crisis. So I think the president and the White House have tried to figure out a way that they might shift the narrative to make it sound like there are other important reasons to continue to have the government shut down over this issue. The humanitarian crisis is something that might appeal to some people, because certainly there's a lot of public opinion that is concerned about the way that migrants and asylum seekers are suffering in detention camps. But I think it's strategically an odd position for the president to make, since it is his policy that has been detaining families and separating families and putting people in these detention centers. So he has, through his executive powers, you know, the power to change some of the circumstances of the humanitarian crisis at the border. I think the other thing that is interesting about it is some of the things he called for last night, you know, more money for more asylum judges and you know, different people to be on the ground to help facilitate the situation that migrants are facing. Those are some of the things on which the Democrats would agree. So his words were talking about his support for things that the Democrats also support, but then his actions today didn't seem to be interested in trying to make a compromise around those issues. So it's really sort of hard to understand where he's going with the humanitarian narrative.
Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Milwaukee, and we're talking about the president's primetime speech last night from the Oval Office. Now, the president didn't mention a declaration of emergency to construct a border wall, but he also didn't rule it out. What are the political consequences of a move such as that?
Well, you know, there are a couple of them. One is that it is not settled opinion that the president would have the powers to declare a crisis of this sort, and to one of the things he has specifically talked about is diverting money from the Defense Department budget to building the wall. It's not clear, you know, whether this fits the definition of an emergency situation under which a president can declare a crisis according to the National Emergencies Act that was passed by Congress in the 1970s. It's also not clear whether he would really get support from Congress and even some Republicans in Congress. I mean, there have been suggestions that people in Congress, members of Congress, would file suit to try to stop him from diverting money, say, from the Defense Department. So it's not clear he has the power to do it. It's not clear he would have the political support to do it. And if he declared such an emergency and then started to lose support among Republican members of Congress, then he's got an even bigger kind of political problem. So it's not clear that it is, from a policy perspective, a winning position, or really from a political perspective.
Let's listen to a little bit of how the Democrats responded to President Trump last night. Here's how Democratic Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi opened her remarks.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak directly to the American people tonight about how we can end this shutdown and meet the needs of the American people. Sadly, much of what we heard from President Trump throughout this senseless shutdown has been full of misinformation and even malice.
So there's not an indication or any indication of a soon-to-come compromise there. First, though, has the president successfully put the pressure back on Democrats with his address?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't think so, really. I think that the president has been very clear about his, you know, being dug in on this border wall money being the be-all and end-all to him. I don't know that he made the case last night strongly enough to shift public opinion toward him on this issue, which is really the only weapon that he might have at this point to sort of push Democrats in Congress. And you know, if the speaker continues with the plan that she had laid out, if the House starts voting on individual appropriations bills one by one to open certain parts of the government, and if she can get, you know, those passed through the House, and then if the Senate joins on, then little by little they can start to kind of chip away at some of the agencies and reopen some things. And then I think, you know, the burden does shift to him to come toward them more with a compromise.
What do we know about the political consequences for the party or the official seen as responsible for the shutdown?
Well, you know, we're getting to a point where the impact is really becoming clear. You know, people who work for the federal government are starting to miss paychecks for the first time. We're starting to hear reports today about, you know, the number of food safety inspectors who are not on the job and the sort of sick outs that we've been hearing among people who might work for TSA. And so as more people are inconvenienced at airports, as people might become concerned about the safety of our food supply, you know, those sorts of tangible things that affect everybody, that will start to, you know, ratchet up the pressure, and that will start to really, I think, put more kind of, you know, more pressure on the leaders. Who's going to blink first? You know, what kind of compromise there's going to be here remains to be seen, certainly. But I think that the Democrats and the leaders in Congress are probably going to try to figure out ways, you know, to create and craft some sort of compromise. But I don't see Congress giving the president the full $5 billion that he wants here.
And finally, Kathy, with about a minute left, how important is it for President Trump's 2020 reelection bid to actually get this border wall funding as opposed to just putting up a good fight?
You know, I think it's probably pretty important. You know, he has clearly made immigration his number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 12 issue. he clearly, you know, wants to make sure that his base is behind him. But I think the biggest danger for him here is that he starts to lose the Republicans in Congress, because it was very clear during the midterm elections that almost every person in Congress who was a Republican, whether they actually agreed with the president or not, was on board. If the shutdown and pressure from their constituents starts to cause individual Republicans to step away from him and he starts to lose that support, I think he endangers himself, because I don't think the Democrats are going to be anything but unified for the next couple of years.
To be continued. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem.
That was Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor and Chair of UW-Milwaukee's Political Science Department. She was with us to dissect President Trump's first address to the nation last night, the Democratic response, and where it leaves negotiations over the government shutdown.
Coming up, we find out more about a one-of-a-kind Eau Claire race that takes a new approach to the beer mile by adding snowshoes. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, have you ever tried running in snowshoes? What about after a beer or two? Well, there you have it, the concept of the Snowshoe Beer Mile hosted in Eau Claire. We'll learn more coming up.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Marie McCollum with a young farmer's story.
Dairy farms in Wisconsin. Today, fewer than 10,000 remain. The Detman family are descendants of German immigrants and have a dairy farm in Johnson Creek. For more than 100 years, the family farm has expanded, modernized, and have partially relied on laborers from Mexico and Central America. Drew Detman is the oldest of the sixth generation of Detman family farmers, and he intends to stick with it. The Lands We Share Farming History Project recently caught up with the 14-year-old at the Jefferson County Fair and his family farm.
So mostly what the judges are looking for in the heifer classes are their feet and legs, their frame, all that stuff that makes them look dairy, I guess you could say. The cows here at my farm at least have a lot of neck fat. So what you can do in the ring is you can have one hand on the halter and the other hand you can have pulling up some of that fat so she doesn't look too chunky. It's serious, but it's mostly just people bringing their cows to show them at the fair and have fun with their friends. I'm Drew Detman. I am 14 and currently we are up at our farm. I feel like this is a pretty good size right now, because it depends on how you all look at it. When you're not comparing it to the other bigger farms, you think it's, oh wow, this is a big farm, 500 cows all in one spot, and that's pretty big. But then you think about all the 10,000 cow farms and you realize that we're kind of small. So in the dairy prospect of farming, you can definitely see the bigger farms are thriving more right now, just because of the lower milk prices, and the little farms are starting to get snuffed out one after another, sadly. Well, I first started driving the Gator, which is a side-by-side off-road vehicle. I first started driving that when I was about 11, which is a lot later than other farm kids, but hey, I mean, we got a lot of farmhands on the farm that do a lot of the work, so I didn't grow up in a family where I really needed to go out when I was six and start milking cows, so it's My dad would be down there because he was the herd manager, which means he had all the shot records and all the medicines that he needs to give everyone. And now that Juan works here, he's actually the herd manager. Now he's starting to take over some of that responsibility from my dad since my dad started running the farm. A few workers know broken English, but usually it's just Spanish that they're talking to each other with, so it was fun to hang out with them. They'd always try and teach me as much Spanish as they could, but, you know, I just went through the first class this past year in eighth grade, so starting to learn. I can count to 100 now, so. My grandpa took over the farm, then he got drafted for the war, and then when he got back, he took it back over, and then my dad is starting to take over now. So they're half and half right now. My grandpa owns half and my dad owns half. So someday it'll all be mine. It feels special to have that much history behind you going into the business. Because I feel like if my dad would have just started it, there wouldn't be so much pressure for me to take over it. But I feel like it's a great thing to take on, you know, carrying on the family tradition, you know. Because my dad and mom mostly, they keep telling me that, you know, oh, you don't have to go into farming. You can go into something else. You can go be a chef at McDonald's if you want to. But, yeah, I've thought about other things. But, I don't know, there's just something about it that having a family farm in Wisconsin, you know, family dairy farm in Wisconsin, it just seems glamorous, so.
This story is part of the Lands We Share project and was edited by Craig Ely. The exhibit is in Johnson Creek through January, with a community conversation and dinner happening later this month. To reserve a spot for the dinner and learn more, visit landsweshare.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, packing a cooler full of beer and other beverages is generally thought of as a summertime kind of activity, but participants in a one-of-a-kind running event in Eau Claire might need to bust out their coolers to keep their beverages from freezing, maybe some heating pads, too.
We're talking about the Snowshoe Beer Mile. It is exactly what it sounds like, with participants drinking beer and running in snowshoes with only one rule. If your snowshoe falls off, you must put it back on before continuing.
Tim McManus is president of the Eau Claire chapter of the Hash House Harrier Social Running Group. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I know the Hash House Harriers, it's this social running. There's beer involved, not too competitive. How did you make the leap onto snowshoes?
Well, we started hosting the Beer Mile was becoming really popular around the time we started our chapter of the group. And so we did them in the summer, and after about our second Beer Mile, it's a little bit hazy as to who's, who came up with the idea, but the conversation went along the lines of, oh, we don't want to wait a whole nother year to do this. This is a lot of fun. We could do it in the winter. Yeah, we could wear snowshoes with it, and it kind of just went from there. We took it and ran, and now we're getting ready for Beer Mile number 4.
Now, running in snowshoes plus beer. I'm not that coordinated to begin with. This sounds easier said than done, right?
Yeah, it's awkward. It's clumsy when you get in them right away. I had walked and hiked in snowshoes before I'd done the first Snowshoe Beer Mile, but once you put them on and actually start running, there is a big difference. And we found, too, the weather element has been huge in affecting how your performance is. We had our first year, we were running on ice the whole time, below zero. The second year, everything had melted. There were puddles and ponds everywhere. And last year, we had probably perfect conditions for it. So the weather, too, is just changes the course of the event from year to year.
Now, spell out that we mentioned one of the rules. Spell out the basic rules for someone to successfully complete their beer mile.
So we were almost exactly to the T like a traditional beer mile. You have to drink 4 beers, and you have to run 4 quarter-mile laps. And it goes drink, run. You do that 4 times. And even all the other, there's some other stipulations and more nitpicky rules. We do those the same, too. The only difference is you have snowshoes on, and you're running it through our course that we have usually, hopefully this year we'll see, with a lot of snow to factor in with that.
And how do the times compare the run versus the snowshoe?
They're, you know, some of the top people, they're getting a little closer between the summer one and the winter one. I would say usually about 5 to 10 minutes you can expect to be slower during a winter beer mile than the summer one. But, you know, this is number four we have coming up now. So we've gotten, several of us have gotten the hang of it. There's a lot of competitions and rivalries going. So it's on, and those times are getting better each year.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the competitiveness level because it's partly for the social aspect and for the fun, but people are running, are snowshoeing to win here.
Yeah, we have, you know, over the last few years, we've taken a lot of feedback from this event and experimented with different things. And kind of one of the big things we heard from a lot of people is, oh, this sounds like a really fun event. I'd like to do it, but I don't know if I'd like to drink four beers. And we're like, well, that's understandable. That's actually probably a normal response that someone would have to a question like that. But we didn't want that to be the sole reason for just deterring them from coming to the event altogether. So over the last few years, we've actually added several other events that we have. So we have the traditional snowshoe beer mile, and that's, you know, we have everyone from competing, you know, myself and several other people that are just diehard for it. It is race on. We're going tooth and nail the whole time. We have people who like to just come up and, you know, complete it and do it and enjoy it. But we also have a half beer mile race that we do. So you cover the same distance, you're running a mile, you're only drinking a half beer each lap. We have an open mile now that you can do any beverage, any amount. People have done mixed drinks, shots, chocolate milk, soda, and probably our biggest one that we've had. Yeah, I did. The chocolate milk was a bad idea. I would not recommend that one. But our biggest event that we've had, an addition that we've added, is a four-person relay race for our finale. So we get into teams of four. Each person has one lap and one drink that they have to do, and that's just a really fun finale to the whole afternoon.
We'll leave it there. Tim, I'll let you get back to training. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I want to give a shout-out to my mom, Melanie. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
All right. That's Tim McManus with the Eau Claire chapter of the Hash House Harrier Social Running Group talking about the annual Snowshoe Beer Mile Race. Happens this year, weather permitting, on January 19th. Coming up, we'll ask you to weigh in. What do you miss in the days before the Internet? This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, seeking fertility treatment is a highly personal decision. But in the big picture, fertility is a big business with a lot of money at stake. A guest takes us inside the fertility economy. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, there will always be differences between older and younger generations, but right now we have kind of a unique situation. We have younger generations who will never know what the world was like without the internet, and we have older generations with many people who maybe miss some part of the pre-internet past.
We asked our Wisconsin public media staff to think about what they miss most about life before the internet and got many responses. Here's a few to think about.
Karina said, I imagine that passing notes is a thing of the past, that kids just text and private message each other these days. One of my friends in middle school and I shared a notebook that we'd hand off to each other in the hallway between classes. And there were the notes that were folded into a triangle, and I could never get folded back into that shape. Playing paper fortune teller was fun, too. I could say my kids still did that.
Judith Kay had a lot of travel-related things that she missed. She said, I was a teenager in the 1970s, and we did several family car trips out west. Months ahead, we'd look at the map for places we may want to go, then call or write for brochures for national and state parks, tourist sites, etc. I remember being thrilled when it arrived in the post.
And Dean in our Eau Claire Bureau said he missed having to rely on U.S. mail to keep track of fantasy football scores.
Wow.
And results. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you miss most about life before the internet? And if you're a younger listener, do you ever wonder about how certain things were done without things like Google Maps? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Keith Hampton joins us now for a look at how the internet has changed our lives. Keith is a professor in the Department of Media and Information in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences at Michigan State University. He studies community and the relationship between digital technologies. Keith, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Now, Keith, you ask your students to think about this question, too, and I imagine being in your line of work, you've given plenty of thought to it as well. What do you think about thinking about life pre-internet? I mean, should we be giving more thought to this?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, this is a question that, you know, predates the internet. I mean, we've been looking back, usually nostalgically, at what relationships and community and life was like before the latest technology, since the last technology. So it's something that we think a lot about in our course, when we think about how there's this kind of growing sense that new media are destroying our lives, destroying our relationships. And we ask the students to look back and give examples of what it must have been like, for their parents or their grandparents.
What kind of things do you hear for them? What kind of things do they ask in the how the heck did you do that category?
Well, the most common ones usually revolve around music. You know, how did you survive when you couldn't just order up the latest song on the internet, when you had to sit there and listen to the radio for the song you wanted to play? And then if you wanted to keep it without buying it, you had to record it on this tape-like device, right?
I tell you what I used to do was we had a friend whose dad bought all like the latest albums. So we'd get a blank cassette and go over there and we'd record it all from his record player. So that's what we did. But before the internet, what you knew was based on who you knew and talked with, and now what you know is based on what websites you spend the most time on. Do you think that the evolution of the internet is just another generational difference and change, or do you think that this is something really different?
It's an extremely difficult question, because so much of the information that we're basing this question on is based on a misunderstanding of what the past was like. I mean, sure. We don't really have good data on what it used to be. And as a result, so much of our perception of the past is based on this, the pasture must have been greener kind of mythology, where, relationships were fantastic and everybody knew their neighbors and relationships were oh so close and you could just go outside and have friends around you. And it probably wasn't like that, and it probably never was like that. And so understanding how the internet is changing those relationships and changing the community becomes really complicated.
Right. Do you think a lot of the cases made for, I guess, the damage being done by the internet are driven more by that nostalgia or by that fear of the change rather than the reality of then and now?
Yeah, I think most of it is based on a misunderstanding of what relationships were like in the past and a nostalgia for those types of close relationships without recognizing the kind of stressors and problems with relationships that have always been there. So, for example, I mean, it's one thing to have, close relationships, but for anyone from, a really small town knows, I mean, being surrounded by close relationships comes at a cost too. And that cost is gossip and social pressures and, maybe even things like ostracism. And we tend to forget about that when we say, oh, I wish I was just constantly surrounded by all these close friends all the time.
Right. I sometimes think like, okay, if I went back and told people in the 1970s, if I traveled back in time, like, wow, you guys are living in this great utopia. You don't know the bad stuff that's coming. They'd be like, what? Really? Us?
Yeah. I mean, they would say, oh, no, you misunderstand. The utopia was 20 years ago.
Yeah, right. And we do have bell bottoms, but that's it.
Yeah. we had a couple of responses that talked about this, but I think Susanna summed it up best when she said, I miss the quiet. Now, I know our phones are always with us and not a lot of time for daydreaming. We're always reading other people's thoughts online. What do you think about this idea that we don't have as much quiet headspace as we used to?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it as, not having quiet. I think of it more as, I miss, not being reached. And it's not even just the cell phone constantly ringing, because really I don't actually give out my cell phone number to a large number of people.
Oh, good
for
you.
But it's just, the constant, number of emails from people I don't know who expect a reply, or, text messages throughout the day, even from my kids who I love and want to hear from. I probably don't need to know what they had for lunch right at that moment. I can wait till dinner. So stuff like that probably, you know, I could do without for sure.
We're talking to Keith Hampton from Michigan State University. We're talking about life before and after the advent of the internet and everything that comes with it, the social media, the smartphones to access it all. And you could join in at 800-642-1234, whichever side of the divide you're on. What do you miss, if anything, from the pre-internet days? If you grew up with the internet, what questions do you have about life before the internet? Let's go to your calls now. Willie is with us in Steuben. Willie, hi.
Hey, I'm here. Here's the thing. I was born in 1966, and it seemed like things were pretty simple. Steuben, probably lots of people don't know where that is, but it's kind of in Nowheresville, down by Boss Bell, Prairie Sheen area. And we had a party line, and that's a landline with four other houses on the same line. And you pick up your phone, and you can hear them talking if they're on the phone, and you have to wait for them to get off, for people who are not familiar with how a party line works. But it was very common for people to just pick up the phone and listen to your neighbors talking in their conversation. It was like this little spying thing, you know, but we weren't talking anything about it. It was like the price of milk, or, you know, if you're going to be able to haul manure tomorrow, you know.
Willie, thanks a lot for sharing that. I can't see any downside to that. Now if I want to listen to somebody else's phone conversation, I just have to sit on the bus for a while. So, Keith, these things change really quickly, right? I mean, party lines by the time I was a kid were done for. Maybe if we're trying to put a pin in right now, it's going to change a lot in 5 or 10 years anyway.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating to hear him recall that story because, of course, the telephone was incredibly intrusive at the time and mm-hmm. was viewed as this kind of, you know, demonish technology that was allowing, you know, voices into your private home. Who knew what the women of the household were talking about when the men weren't around? I mean, who knew what your neighbors were doing? Well, now you know. And it was incredibly controversial. It was viewed, you know, much as new technologies today, as something that was, again, destroying families, you know, corrupting the children inside the home. I mean, who knew what it was doing to people's dating habits? I mean, it was just out of control.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Angela in De Pere. Good afternoon, Angela. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi. I'm just calling because the hugest thing that I really miss is actually going to the record store and being able to pick out music that you like, or just the excitement of waiting for a new release to come out and knowing that you're not going to hear the whole album until it actually is physically released.
Angela, thank you so much for the call. I actually missed that too, going to the record store and picking out records and then going to record release parties. Yeah, it is very, very different now. Keith, what do you remember about those days? Did you go out and get records and you know, go home and listen to them?
You know what I miss most probably is the mixtape. I mean, there was something special, right?
Yes.
About somebody giving you that mixtape. It meant that, you know, unlike you guys who apparently had unlimited access to records. I mean, they were rare for me, and to have a friend or a girlfriend put together a mixtape for you meant that they, you know, put thought into it, and it took huge amounts of time, right? So I certainly, you know, miss something like that.
Yeah, it helped. I worked at a couple of record stores, uh-huh. So that was the reason for my collection. We're talking with Keith Hampton, professor in the Department of Media and Information in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences at Michigan State University. He studies community and the relationship between digital technologies.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our question for you, is there something you miss about life in the pre-internet days? If you're a younger person, what do you think you would miss if you were in a world without the internet, without social media and the smartphones to access it all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit right here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We continue our conversation talking about what you miss most about life before the internet. Keith Hampton is our guest. He's a professor in the Department of Media and Information at Michigan State University.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you miss, if anything, about life pre-internet? What's the biggest change in your life with the internet? Or if you have a question about how you did stuff without being able to go online to do it, want to hear that too. Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Three Lakes. Hi there, Mark. What did you want to tell us about?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I am a 60-plus-year-old person who is computer illiterate, deal with snail mail, and having a hard time getting things done because of not knowing how to work the computer, and physical problems are kicking in, cataracts and bad back, blah, 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 blah. And I guess I'm looking for answers, but have found none.
Mark, for a little help, you can check out your local library. I have some connections to libraries, and they are always looking to help people with their computer needs, people in your situation. Thanks for calling in. That is a big change, though, Keith, the switch from snail mail to computers. I remember I bought a book once, a game book. There was a page missing, so I wrote a letter to the address, and 4 weeks later, I got the missing page. It was a slower pace. That wasn't necessarily a better thing, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not even the pace of information that we can find through news sites and searching, but it's also the pace of information that we get from those in our everyday lives. I mean, I think the thing I probably miss the most is not knowing. And, you know, it's amazing just how much information comes to you today. And there are opinions and feelings about, you know, certain distant relatives and friends I would otherwise probably not have kept in touch with that I'm now all too aware of, and I probably could have lived without knowing.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Cindy in La Crosse. Good afternoon, Cindy. Welcome to Central Time.
Hello. What I miss most is actually spending time in the library. I used to, as a kid and as a young adult, for research papers, the smell of a library, the creaking of the wood chairs and tables, and the people that you would meet there quietly. Now you can do that all at your fingertips.
Cindy, thank you so much for the call. Keith, what do you think about that? I mean, the library is still popular, but it's taken on a whole different meaning. I remember when I had school projects and you had to look things up. You had to go to the library to go look in the encyclopedia, and you couldn't take the encyclopedia home with you. You had to keep it there. So you did have to hang out in the library. How has that changed over the years?
Well, of course, the library is still there, and it still plays a really important point for access for a lot of people. I mean, particularly those in low-income communities, the library remains the most important place to get access to the internet. As my experience, I don't miss all my students handing in a paper based on the same Encyclopedia Britannica. So having wider access to information and those resources, I think, is incredibly important. I mean, for one, I actually don't enjoy going to libraries. I find them very intimidating. So having access to that information at home really does open up new doors to me.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are talking about life pre and post internet. Keith Hampton is with us from the Department of Media and Information at Michigan State University. Back to your calls now. Sura is with us in Viola. Sura, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, there's a couple of things. I miss that people can't plan. They don't say, I'll meet you at 5 o'clock. They say, text me when you're coming. And also people live vicariously a lot instead of having the actual experience. I've also noticed I don't have a cell phone. I'm one of the last holdouts, I think. And it used to be that people would treat me kind of funny about that, like, what's wrong with you, or, you know, get with the program. And more I'm finding people, like, being jealous and wondering how I do it and wanting to do it themselves.
Sura, thanks a lot for the call. She gave us a lot to work with there, Keith. Let's take that middle point. She sees people, because they have access to everyone else's experiences, living vicariously through that instead of having experiences on their own. Do you think there's anything to that you're seeing?
Well, I mean, it's a great observation and a great question. I don't think we really know. I mean, I don't think that there is much veracity to the argument that people are opting out of experiences because they see those around them engaging in new opportunities and exciting experiences of their own. If anything, I would say that seeing what your friends and family are involved in, even those who are kind of, you know, socially distant to you, might open up new opportunities and reveal information about those folks that you didn't know before, and then provide you with opportunities to do, you know, new hobbies or new interests. I mean, I think what's more interesting is her observation about micro-coordination and how everybody today, waits till the last minute to do things, and where you meet up and how you're going to meet up. This is probably one of the strongest pieces of evidence about changes to relationships as a result of the internet.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Michelle in Oconomowoc. Good afternoon, Michelle. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Did you have a question or a statement about this subject?
Yeah, I used to deliver pizzas, and this was before the days of smartphones and GPS, and you'd have to memorize the map on the wall at the pizza place and then, you know, try and drive there and remember, maybe you wrote down your directions. And, you know, if you couldn't find the house, sometimes the pizza would be late, and there were even times when I had to go back to the restaurant, couldn't find the house, had to try and figure it out, call the people from the landline, and can you tell me how to get to your house?
Michelle, thank you so much for the call. Ah, the days of having to learn how to read city maps. I must admit, Keith, that I love the GPS technology. That's one thing I don't miss is GPS versus having to read a map. But she's absolutely right. Back then, you had to know how to get places, and you had to read a map or an atlas to do so.
Yeah, I'm in the don't miss that camp for sure on that. I mean, my phone recently visited a body of water by mistake, and I've only lived in this area now for a couple of years, and I very quickly realized that I couldn't even get myself to the phone store to get a new phone. Dependency on GPS is, a really big change as well. And I do wonder what would happen if we found ourselves, very suddenly without any paper maps.
In our last minute or so, Keith, the internet feels like a big change. It is in a lot of ways. On the other hand, I picture our pre-human ancestors, a parent cleaning the kids. They're sitting around this fire all the time. It's ruining their relationships. Are we always going to have this ambivalence, this maybe fearful reaction to the impact of a new technology?
We're always going to have it. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I think we've had it for every technology since the invention of writing. I mean, certainly the bicycle, the telegraph, the telephone, the newspaper. I mean, one of the first sociologists in America was bewildered by this unusual sudden habit of a piece of paper being delivered to people's homes sometimes twice a day, and the mail of the house sitting around a table staring into this object instead of conversing with his family. But of course, he was talking about the newspaper and not his tablet.
Keith, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
Keith Hampton is a professor in the Department of Media and Information in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences at Michigan State University. He studies community and the relationship between digital technologies and social networks. He joined us today to talk about life before the internet.
Still time for you to share your thoughts and your stories. You can do that on the internet, on the Ideas Network Facebook page.